You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. Today we have the extraordinary privilege of talking to one of New Mexico's great writers and elders, Max Evans. At 93 years old, he's published over 30 books and many short stories, and he's still working. Over the course of his long life, he's written with great depth about ranching and rural life, about animals, about war, and much more. Though some categorize him as a cowboy writer, his admirers in the Western literary world say that his work should be considered part of the canon of American literature, and he's been compared to Mark Twain. Two of his books, The Rounders and The High-Low Country, have been made into movies, the latter produced by Martin Scorsese. He also founded the New Mexico Film Office and was a founding member of the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces. A few months ago, a documentary film about his life, Old Max Evans, The First Thousand Years, premiered at the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival, where it was awarded Best New Mexico Documentary. It's being screened again this Sunday, February 4th, at 1 p.m. at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. I went to Albuquerque the other day with the filmmaker, Lorene Mills, to talk to Max Evans. Lorene is host of the weekly radio and television program, Report from Santa Fe, and she's been talking to Max for decades. Welcome, Max Evans. Welcome, Lorene Mills.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're talking about the film Old Max Evans, The First Thousand Years. How did the idea for this film come to being? Lorene, was this your brainchild?
It was my brainchild. Max and I started doing interviews back with when Ernie Mills was interviewing Max, and I was
your late husband.
Yeah, I was the camerawoman. And every book that you had, I would devour it and say, somebody should do a documentary about Max. He's just amazing. He's incredible. And that was in the 90s. And then
early 90s.
Yeah. And so it finally got to the point where with your last couple of books, I thought, we really have to do this. And I was able, with the help of the Healy Foundation and a fabulous crew who I will name in a minute, we were finally able to make this beautiful documentary about Max, his life and times.
What was it like for you to have a documentary made about you?
Well, I didn't really know they were making a documentary. I thought they were making a 30-minute show. And so it was a pleasant surprise because it was a darn good film. You know, it's hard to make a film, even a 30-minute film, but to do a feature-length documentary is really tough. And very few people bring it off, but they did.
They did indeed. And so this was a process of years.
Yes, it took us a couple of years, but I have to give all the credit for the how well done this film is to my co-producer, Paul Barnes, and to our writer and editor, David Leach. And then we had a brilliant cinematographer, Barry Kirk, sound, Jim Gallup, and our graphic art was done by Jamie Chase. It was just a team of extraordinarily talented people who were as in love with Max and his work as I was. So everybody gave it their best, and it turned out really beautifully.
The film goes kind of chronologically through your life, and one of the things that was kind of striking to me is it talked about your happy childhood. And one of the cliches about writers, I think, is that they all had sort of tormented or unhappy childhoods.
Well, I can't imagine that because I was so happy I couldn't stand it, hardly. I was in the pastures. I had everything, dogs, I could hunt. I had parents that loved me. I loved them. We had a vast open country and down there in the pastures of Lee County. And it was just a paradise to me. I loved every. I think back on it now and I thought, my God, I'd really like to just live it all the same thing right over again.
And you were so multi-talented. I mean, you were good at a lot of things. You were athletic. You were a really good shot. You were great with animals. And you were artistic, too. Did you recognize that about yourself, that you had these sort of, like, creative talents?
Oh, I didn't think about it. You know, I think my mother started reading to me when I could just barely understand her voice. at the time I went to started school, 6 years old, I could read as good as the teacher at that time. We just had one teacher at that little school down there, two-room school, but one teacher. Humble City, New Mexico, in the far southeast corner. And it's just the vast prairies around there, you know, coyotes and rabbits. And it was a poor time. The meat we had to sell to get a little money. So the fact that I knew how to hunt rabbits, had learned how to hunt rabbits and catch them, run them in the holes, twist them out, supplanted our food supply. And it became very important. So without even knowing it, just fitting myself into the circumstances that existed, I was learning all kinds of things. I was learning about animals. I was learning about wildlife. I was learning about the Great Prairies. And it was a wonderful time. I just loved everything about it.
I think it's so interesting that somebody who is a cattle rancher doesn't actually get to eat beef because you have to sell every last cow.
Yeah, that's right.
So you learned to hunt and you learned really to be on the land in a way that most of us don't have the privilege to do. And you got to know animals in such a deep way, I think, one can tell that from your writing.
Well, a life and death way.
Yeah.
You see both elements.
Say more what you mean about that.
Well, I killed them for our food, but I protected them otherwise because I'd grown to love them and realized that they had little souls like we do, that they had feelings, they comprehended one another, they comprehended us better probably than we do. Coyotes certainly do. They understand the human race better than we understand ourselves. I've learned over a long period of time. And so it was a wonderful thing for a kid. And my mother was reading to me all the time. My mind was going out all over the world, me stories. I was out in this vast pasture alone, sometimes afoot, sometimes on my little horse. And I was seeing all these animals, observing them in their life forms. And it was a grand upbringing for a kid. How in the world could you ask for more than that?
You hunted coyotes for a while, and then something happened that made you not hunt them. What happened?
Yeah, that was a turning point in my life, really, because out of it came, I suppose, my best novella, my favorite form of writing, part novel and part short story. And I was running coyotes over in Union County, and these hounds. And they caught this coyote. At the time, I was just so excited for the hunt. And I raced up there. And as I got out of the old pickup, I saw this coyote had pups. And one of them stopped up on the hill. And nature tells that pup to just escape no matter what. And that pup stopped and looked down where my hounds were killing their mother. And that pup, without hesitation, came charging down that hill right into those huge hounds, committing suicide, in actuality, to save its mother. And I could never hunt again. I could never hunt a coyote. I spent the rest of my life wanting to protect them. I just couldn't help it. I was so deeply touched. But out of it, out of this moment, this instantaneous survival instinct and the instinct to kill to survive, out of that came a comprehension that led to what I guess is my best story of my life, The One-Eyed Sky. Anyway, a lot of people have told me that. I don't really know. I can't judge my work that well. But I know I felt it deeply, that story.
And one of the things that's so moving about that story is, I mean, this pup, I mean, we talk about the instinct for survival, and that puppy did exactly the opposite. It, as you said, went to sacrifice itself for its mother, which is something we think of as maybe a human trait, but not necessarily an
Absolutely
animal trait.
Absolutely not. The whole part of their genes is to escape, no matter what, escape the death. And just a pup that's the whole thing, you see. It didn't have any experience to guide it. There was no experience. This hadn't happened before. It couldn't. It wouldn't be there if it happened. But when it saw that, boom, some powerful thing, some great urge from a place we can't to this day explain or understand, it charged to save its mother and gave up its life.
I think there are people who live on the land who know so much more in certain ways about animals than animal biologists, animal scientists, because you have the experience of year after year after year in the same place, as opposed to somebody who comes in, observes, and leaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. I agree with you.
In the movie, there's a scene that sort of shows your introduction to literature, and you started at a very young age reading Balzac and Shakespeare. And I wondered if there were other writers, maybe, or even filmmakers that influenced you over the course of your life.
My favorite writer, besides Balzac and all the world, is a relatively unknown writer named Joyce Carey. He was an Irish writer who moved to London, did his writing out of London. He did The Horse's Mouth, for one. I think he might have indirectly influenced my writing without me ever being aware of it. Maybe this moment is the first time I'm ever really aware of it. But he balanced tragicomedy, the most difficult thing to write on this earth. Shakespeare, as great as he was, he was unable to completely balance it. And Joyce Carey, when he was writing in a certain form, he had a perfect balance of a sense of the tragedy and comedy of the human beast, the life, the existence of it. And I'm sure he must have influenced me. However, he couldn't have influenced me like with the One-Eyed Sky and the Rounders. I wrote those before I read him. But he's a tremendously underrated writer who should be ranked with Balzac and Tolstoy and those people, and isn't. And I'd like to say right now, I hope somebody hears me that can rank him.
Yeah, I never heard him. I'll look for him for sure. That's a word that is used in the film, tragicomic. Do you feel like that kind of describes your own work and view of life, of literature?
Yeah, that's life. Yeah, we exist because tragedy makes us think and feel deeply. And the humor of it gives us the ability to survive that tragedy. That's why the balance of it in life or literature or film or whatever is the ultimate talent.
You were also a painter. Was painting as serious an endeavor for you as writing?
You bet. I made a living at it. I started painting. I can't even remember when I started painting. Nobody influenced me to paint. I just wanted to paint. I can't explain it. I have no explanation to myself even. But I was over on that ranch after World War II, and I'd been to a lot of combat, 6.5 months of straight combat there, and I got back, and I thought, well, how am I going to forget this? These guys are all coming back, going crazy, and they didn't have near as much combat and horrible war as I did, and they're all going crazy. So I decided the nice thing to be I'd always love paintings, no matter where I'd see them. I was just infatuated with paintings. Walk in any place, first thing I do is look at the wall. Did it when I was a kid, I can't explain it, but I guess it's a seeking of beauty some way. And so I started painting out on that ranch. And I thought, well, I have a little talent for it. I did a series of paintings and went over to Amarillo, Texas, and went to the Amarillo Hotel, which, unknown to me as a very young man, was a semi-brothel. So my first art show was at a whorehouse. I think that suited me pretty good. But anyway, some lady came by. I don't know what the hell she was doing there, because she was a dignified lady and she was a great artist known around the world, Ida Strawn Baker. And she looked at one of my paintings and she said, I'd like for you to come and talk to me. And she gave me an address and phone number. And I don't know whether she really expected me to show up or not, but I did. She's just immediately showed me some of her works, and I wondered, what's she doing here in Amarillo? But I found out that her husband had come from there, her late husband. She was there selling up some kind of estate. And she had this powder paint that her husband had invented, three primary colors in powder. And she showed me how you could just mix any color on earth with this very inexpensive thing. And she told me, said, if you go around, I'll arrange everything for you. If you go around the country demonstrating this paint, she said, you can own all the racehorses and whatever you want in the world. She really was a pretty smooth old gal. But I didn't fall for it, but I studied with her just for 3 or 4 days. She taught me enormous things. She showed me how to break down a sombrero, for instance, into an abstract form. And within an hour, I could do it. And from that point on, she had somehow indirectly influenced me. And even though I was already painting, she didn't inspire me to be a painter. She inspired me to think that I might be a good one. So I started painting there in that little old town, Des Moines, up in the northeastern part of New Mexico. And there's only one person in that whole vast country that I could find that really loved art, and that is Luis Martinez, a Hispanic guy, became one of my dearest friends. He worked for the railroad, but he had studied art. It was a mail order catalog, and he was really good. He's a cartoonist. He could really draw. He couldn't paint much. Anyway, we put this little gallery in there, right on the highway. It's a tiny little town. Called it Ye Olde Art Gallery.
Ye Olde Art Gallery.
Yeah, and nobody ever stopped. I think one person, nobody ever came into our gallery. So I decided, well, hell, I'm going to move to Taos and become a painter. And I figured I could move there with the confidence of youth. I thought, well, I'll move over to Taos, and in about 18 months, I'll be rich and famous as an artist. By then, I'd spent all the money I'd gotten out of my little ranch. I was flat and broke. And I was peddling painters around Taos that were still wet. I couldn't afford a frame, so I'd go around and hold them from the back, wet, and take them out. And I'd peddle them. I got to where I could sell them. The artists resented me doing this because they had a hard time selling in those days. Back in the late 40s and early 50s. Most of them were really truly starving artists. But anyway, I got to where I was selling pretty good. And I married Pat, who loved art, had been raised in Taos, and was a good painter herself. She did covers of my books later, some of them. And the next thing I know, I'm actually making a living as a painter. I think back now, if I'd have stayed as a painter, would I be dead? Would I be world famous? Or would be a pauper? Or what the heck would have happened to me? But I was really going. But I don't know what brought me to where I just wanted to write. I couldn't tell the story that I wanted to tell in the painting somehow. So I did a story, a true story, hunting coyotes. Sent it to the Denver Post, and they bought it. I'll never forget the check, $25. That doesn't sound like much, does it? You can't buy a lunch with it that right now. But it was enormous to me. And I'd sold. And the Denver Post at that time dominated the entire center of our country, the West. It was the main paper. You get it in West Texas, right here, all over the Rocky Mountain region, all the way from Canada to Mexico. That was the main paper. And this magazine section was really called Empire. And especially the ranchers and rural people loved this magazine section. They had depended on that for their reading and their information and their relaxation. Well, they wrote a lot of letters in about my story. So then I sold a couple more to the Denver Post. So why? That started me writing. Here I am. 30 books later, I don't know how many short stories and literary journals and stuff, but that's sort of how it all began, just off the top of my old hollow head.
Do you feel like the painting and the writing influenced each other?
Oh, yeah. When I'm writing, I see colors, like a painting in my stories. I can't help it. That's the way I look at it. I don't look at it. It's not black and white. It's just as colors as you're looking right out here, or out in the pastures, or sun up, sunset, the moon, whatever color you love or adjust to. I see them when I write.
You were raised partly by a grandmother who was part Choctaw Indian.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
And she was kind of a spiritualist or a person who had a connection to the spiritual world. I don't know what words you use for that. And she taught you some of that.
Yes.
Tell us more about that. What was that like? What did that mean to you? How did it change you?
Well, it was so natural. I got expelled from school in that little town, Humboldt City, over in New Mexico. And I had a kid had rocked my dog. And I love, as I explained to you already, I love my dog so much. And it's like he'd hit my brother or sister or something. So I ran him up on the porch, and my grandfather gave me a little 10-cent knife for Christmas. So I thought I'd use that knife. So I got him up on the porch and got his hand down on his porch there and stabbed him through the hand and stuck him to the porch. So for some reason, I wasn't in school, but they expelled me from school for doing it. So I had to go over and live with my grandmother over in Texas, just across the border, Ropes, Texas. From then on, I was off and on with her. She had this tremendous influence on my life. And everybody around her, ever near her. At first, I just was interested. I wasn't confused. I just fascinated. People would come for her to give them readings. And I wondered why the people were ashamed to do this. They'd sneak in the back way out on it. She had a little half ranch and half farm, mile out of town. But they'd come and they'd park way down there and they'd come in. They'd want people to know they were having this spiritual. So I heard all that and listened to that. And about a month before she died, Pat and I were down there. We just had been married a little while. And she told us that, "I don't have anything to give you, Maxie." She called me Maxie. She says, "You and Pat come in the kitchen here. I want to give you a gift." So she said, I read these tea leaves, and said, "Here's how I do it." She showed me how you turn the cup, how you look in there, and you read the grounds. And I don't know. I just could do it, you know. And I have no explanation for that at all. My mentor, Woody Crumble, liked to drove me crazy. He lived in town there in Taos. He was my artistic mentor years later. And we lived 4 miles out of town. Pat and I had this little ranch out there. He drove out every single day over this old rough road for I don't know how long to have me read his tea leaves. Here's a guy that's got paintings in world museums. Winston Churchill collected him, people like that around the world. He's riding, coming out there. But the things that I saw unrelated to him, I don't know what, they just happened. The Korean War came, and I saw it way in advance, exactly. Couldn't believe it was coming. Told him about it. Things like that. I mean, they became so common to me that I'm kind of feel weird talking to you about it right now.
Do you think it's part of the artistic process? Like, do you think it's part of your storytelling, that kind of, I mean, people call it supernatural, you might call it natural ability?
Oh, yeah, without any question. Sure. You're able to absorb things and then project them back in the form of writing. And as I said, in my writing, I see colors. When I'm writing, I'm painting, actually. You see, doing both. I'm painting with colors with black and white words. Print.
Yeah. One of the things that was kind of interesting in the movies was it said that at a certain point you almost had to make a choice between your writing and your spiritualism or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that was hard to do.
Why was it a choice?
Well, you know, let me explain something to you. I'm sorry to take this time, but in the early days in Taos, they had no mail delivery. So every day, everybody that had anything going that could possibly be connected to the Postal Service, you would meet at that post office. You see everybody in town. Here'd be the artists, here'd be the businessmen, here'd be all, and there we'd be. Well, all of a sudden, I was reading these people's minds. I didn't want to read their minds. I'm hearing their thoughts. Well, that sounds like you'd be all thrilled about that. But allow me to be sure, if it ever happens to you, to tell you that you really don't want to have that happen. Because the human thoughts come in spasmodic spurts. They don't have a continuity to them. They jump here and there and around and around. And I'm hearing all these people think all these things. I didn't want to hear it, so I didn't know what the heck to do about it. I didn't ask to be able to do this. I didn't think it's magic or anything like that. I just thought it's an affliction, for Christ's sake. I didn't want other people's minds cluttered up my head unless I wanted them to. So I asked my mentor, Woody Crumbo. I had taken him once to the Paul Bernal, the great medicine man at Taos Pueblo, and I'd seen him fix a compound fracture and set it perfectly with his own formula. It's a cast. It worked. In 14 days, he could use his arm with a compound fracture. Well, that was miraculous to me. I still think it's a miracle. So I went to him, and I told him, I said, this is driving me crazy. I said, I'm getting where I can't pay that. People come to see me all the time, or I go to the post office, or I walk down the street, and I'm hearing what they're thinking. I'm absorbing it somehow. And he took me very seriously, and he said, well, he said, let me ask you, Mr. Evans. He called me Mr. Evans, which embarrassed me, because he was Mr. Bernal to me. I couldn't even imagine me being called Mr. Evans, little punk kid, stupid little artist. But anyway, Mr. Bernal said, which do you want to be? Do you want to be an artist, or do you want to be a spiritualist? I said, I want to be an artist. All right. Well, it was very simple. He gave me two peyote buds. He told me, you go home now. He knew where I lived. He said, you go home, you take these peyote buds. He didn't call it that. He called it something else. I forget what he called it. And he said, you go to bed, and you just stay there. He said, you look at the wall away from the bed. It'll come to you. The decision will be made for you. Well, I believed him. So I went in, and I asked Pat if she'd to go to town to do something. So she did. She understood this. So I had this vision. They filmed it in the film, Lorraine and Paul Barnes, those people. They put that in this film. I saw this beautiful green water river. It's so clear that you could actually see the sand separate in the bottom, beautiful whitish sand. And on the other side, this guy walked up, a man walked on the other side of the river and motioned me across like this. Waved his arm.
Pulling
at
your,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Waved his arm like this for me to come across that river. And I didn't, no, I didn't go. And then it gradually went away, just like a film fading. It gradually went away, and I was cured.
And so after that, you didn't hear people's thoughts. Was it something that you ever wanted to turn,
no.
Like turn on the switch again?
No. I had enough imagination and the power of observation to know sort of what they were thinking anyway, so
right.
I certainly didn't want to hear it anymore. Wonderful relief, and that's the story of how I was spared that affliction.
How did you get into the world of film? Your movies being made into films, you started writing screenplays. How did that happen?
Oh, that was Sam Peckinpah. He was a young filmmaker in Hollywood. He'd been doing TV shows and several of them that were big hits. So they gave him a feature film to do, Ride the High Country, with two old actors that were there, Joel McRae and Randolph Scott. They were, so he did this film and they threw it away, put it out in four or five theaters. But in Paris, they started standing in line around blocks to see this movie. So it started making it, getting attention. They were writing it up and variety about what a hit it was, a European, and how they'd thrown it away in America. So they brought it back. Out of this, he became a cult hero in the film world. At that time, he was a very young man. My agent had submitted him my book. It's just been published at the same time he was having all this go through him. I had published The High-Low Country. So I had a young agent, young director, and me. I was young then, believe it or not, that far away. And he took The High-Low Country to Sam Peckinpah. He read it. He called my agent, and he said, "Hey, I want to meet the SOB that wrote that book. I want to meet him." And my agent told him, "Well, buy him a plane ticket and a motel room. I'll see if we can get him to come out." So that's how I got in films. I went out there. I sat down and had lunch with Sam Peckinpah across from Warner Brothers Studio. At noon, and we were kicked out at 2 o'clock that night. The next day, you see me all the way the next day.
Wow.
We spent 14 hours visiting, drinking and talking and having fun. We became deep and abiding friends, and even though he had a reputation for destroying people, we somehow got along our whole lives. Yeah.
Did you continue to work together?
Yeah, he wanted to make The High-Low Country so bad he couldn't stand it. But he got outlawed, and it's a film world. The studios started barring him, and after The Wild Bunch, he had that huge hit, and then he went kind of crazy. I did a film with him in Nevada, acted in it, and helped supervise his script and one thing and another. But he could never get The High-Low Country made. That's how we became friends. That's how you asked me how I started in film. That's it.
Yeah. You also had a film produced by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah. Well, that very book, The High-Low Country, it's amazing how many directors, Tommy Grass and all kinds of world-famous directors, fell in love with that book, and none of them could get it made, including Sam Peckinpah. He auctioned it about 3 or 4 times. But we lived, Pat and I lived about 2 years or 3 off of options that Sam had picked up. It just led to all these other things. Led into the film world. You get in that film world, and it's just like the writing world. You're living in it. I fell in love with Federico Fellini's works. He's still my favorite director. I dedicated my finest book, Blue Feather Fellini, to Federico Fellini. So that was the movie world, the way I started. And Martin Scorsese found out he'd made a film in Las Vegas, and I think it's L.Q. Jones, one of the character actors that worked on the film, Casino, it was a film called Casino. And they had wrapped the film, and they were all getting ready to leave town. And I think it's L.Q. Jones, might have been Slim Pickens, I don't remember. One of them said to Martin Scorsese, he said, "Have you ever made a Western?" He said, "No, I've always wanted to, but I never found one I felt like making. Felt like putting the time in. Never found a script or a book." So he said, "Well, Sam Peckinpah has spent 20 years of his life trying to make a book." So he wrote me. I got a letter from Martin Scorsese, and he asked if I could send him a copy of that book and was it available and one thing or another. So I fired off a copy. And I'd won an award in the Cowboy Hall of Fame, Wrangler Award for Best Story of Some Kind of Year. Pat and I were back there, and our daughter, Charlotte, called us. She was staying here taking care of this house. And she said, "There's a guy called here, Martin Scorsese." She said, "Is it, Daddy, is it the Martin Scorsese you knew?" I said, "Yeah. What did he want?" He said, "He wanted to talk to you about making The High-Low Country." And to this day, he's still that powerful and that talented. So he got it made. He produced it. Yeah.
Now, you've written screenplays also. Did any of them get made?
When Sam got blackballed, I worked with him under the table on scripts. And several of them, you know, you're not allowed to talk about it. That was a thing you can't talk about. Neither one of us could, because we're breaking all the rules of the guilds and things. So anyway, I worked on a lot of stuff with Sam under the table. Yeah, they were made, a lot of them. Not a lot, several. One seems like a lot when you work on a script. Yeah.
Over the course of your life, I mean, you're a prolific author. You've written, what, over 30 books?
Yeah.
Do you ever reread, or have you spent time rereading your own works? Or are you always moving forward?
I never have reread one of my stories. I've been wanting to while I'm still here, you know. I'm 93 and a half years old. I don't know if I could finish my favorite book, Lupe the Fellini, but of my own, I mean. But I've been about 2 weeks, I've been thinking about rereading that. I haven't finished that book. Ernie Mills, Doreen's husband, and Doreen interviewed me. The first interview I ever had on that book was with them. Ernie interviewed me, and Doreen was the camerawoman. That was a quarter of a century ago. So I haven't read any. No, I'd like to go back and read it because it's been a special book to me.
Are you still working on projects, or have you left writing?
No, I have a novel. I finished it. But Pat is my editor. She edits my books because we didn't learn this for quite a while. But she knows my work and where I came from. She understands the land. And so if she edits one of my works, then they don't fool with it at the publisher, goof it up. So I've turned it over to her, my new book, which I don't know how to explain this. I started writing it about 40 years ago, and I got part of it done and put it back and forgot all about it. Then here a while back, about 3 years ago, I discovered it in my desk, and I thought, what is that? My God, this is pretty darn good, but it's just part of a book. It's just part. I wonder why I quit this. So I got to study it and thinking about it. And I thought, well, I want that to be my last novel because I believed that I could come as close to any American writer had ever come to balancing a tragicomedy with this book. King of Taos is the name of it. So I did it.
And so now it's finished?
It's finished, except can't get her to edit it because she's having trouble with her eyes. She read it, and she knows it's a hell of a book, but she also knows it needs some editing. And I trust her implicitly because, for instance, in the High-Low Country, when I got that book done, I knew something was wrong. I just couldn't figure out why, because I knew everything was authentic. The dialogue was all true and pure, and the land was all described in a proper way. It was related to the people and the animals thereon. And Pat read it, and she said, this chapter's out of place. This chapter needs to be here. It's that simple. My book worked. I got a great film out of it. Martin Scorsese's a buddy, you know, climbing to New York, having dinner with Martin Scorsese. That ain't bad for an old worn-out cowboy. So it's just a... That little editing, I depend on her. I totally trust her. So she's got the book. She's read it, and she's already told me one thing that I need to do, which I'm going to do maybe tomorrow, hope. But she's having so much trouble with her eyes, I don't know what I'm going to do. But it's a beautiful book, King of Taos.
Do you follow young writers, young Western writers? Have you been able to teach younger people, mentor them?
I certainly tried to, and I like to do that. But there's so few writers here in the West, the Southwest, that have experienced the land. There's a lot of writers that write about it, but have really been deeply into the land here. So I haven't had the influence that I'd like to have. I've helped certain writers. One writer I especially admire, Slim Reynolds. Yeah, I hoped I helped him a little. He's certainly worthy. And he has been on the land, and he's a good writer, and he's done some good things. In fact, he was my biographer, so I trusted him that much. So he's just an example. He's in the film they just made. Graham Lee's a fine writer, too, and I've tried to help Graham and several others.
Yeah.
I love it. I love the opportunity to help them. I remember being helped myself, you know.
Yeah. Loreen, tell us a little bit more about the process that you went through in making the film. This was the first and only film that you've made.
Yeah, I've been with public television for a long time, doing short interview programs report from Santa Fe. But this is a feature-length film. And frankly, Max's life and experiences are so big, it was hard to even get it down into that. It really should have been a 10-hour miniseries. But for all the years that we'd interview Max about his books, I would hang on his stories. I just tell me a story, Max, and he would tell these wonderful stories, a lot of which I have archived. These interviews are on my website, reportfromsantafe.com. And so I kept waiting. I said, somebody's got to do a documentary. This is the best writer I've ever read, you know. And so finally it became clear that if someone was going to do it, it was going to be me, and I just put my whole heart into it. I did assemble a brilliant team, who I mentioned before, but particularly Paul Barnes, who is an editor, videographer. We're co-producers on this.
And he's Ken Burns' editor.
He worked with Ken Burns for 30 years, so it's that quality, and so I thank Paul from the bottom of my heart. We were able to get Sam Elliott, one of the most esteemed voice artists and actors in America. He reads the excerpts from Max's writing, and his voice and Max's words go together so beautifully. And he was in the High Low Country.
Yeah, he was.
Yes.
Played the lead villain.
Yeah. And then we got Peter Coyote, who's done all that work on the Roosevelts, the Vietnam War, you know, all of Ken Burns' films. He was our narrator. And again, these people were so happy to work with Max and to help us complete something that is not as much as you deserve, but it's at least a good representation for people who don't know you and don't know your work and your life to see this. There's a couple of things I'd like to mention. Besides living this wonderful, extraordinary life, and he's done so much, he's been, of course, movie producer, cowboy, rancher, writer, painter, landed on D-Day in World War II. I mean, just, you've had the most amazing life. But some things that he doesn't mention too much, one of his early connections with films was one of his early books, The Rounders, was made into a movie that everyone in America saw in the 60s with Glenn Ford and Henry Fonda, and wasn't Burt Kennedy the mm-hmm. director? And so people just loved his portrayal of these wranglers and their way of life. And as a result of that, and you can still see it all the time, it's really worth watching, but the Agriculture Department of the state of New Mexico instituted an award called the Rounders Award for people who've made contributions to the West, and all sorts of famous people have gotten, but it's named after Max. He was the first recipient. Lo and behold, what, 15 years later, Pat got a Rounders
yeah.
Award for
editing.
Yeah. So that's an important factor, too. And I just want to mention that on February 11th, the Film Union, John Henry and IATSE, are putting together the New Mexico Hall of Fame for Film and Television. And Max is one of the inductees, because in addition to this extraordinary life, he was instrumental in founding the New Mexico Film Commission 50 years ago. And that because of your early work, New Mexico has become a magnet for filmmaking. So thank you, Max.
Well, you're certainly welcome. Yeah, I forgot about that. That was an old Governor Cargo, you know. He couldn't get anybody to call him. He formed a film commission with 8 or 10 of us, and he couldn't get anybody out there to call him, any of the big producers, to answer his calls. So he called me, and he told me his problem. He'd asked if I'd had any idea what to do about it, and I said, well, I think so. Let me go out and try. So I was so stupid, I didn't ask for any money. I wound up paying for this whole deal on my own money, which was hard to do at that time. But I got it done. I went out there, and it sounds like bragging. I can't tell it any other way, though. I spent 2.5 weeks. I got my agent. I got my friends, Sam and Peckinpah and Burt Kennedy and Tommy Grice and a whole bunch of people. Old Dan Blocker even helped me. And I got 56 directors and producers for a breakfast meeting at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And the governor came with 2 or 3 people, and they brought a little documentary they'd made on New Mexico, 15 minutes long. So here's all these big producers, Duke Wayne, the whole, his son, the producer of all his films, and all these kind of people. Really the power of Hollywood. I don't know how in the hell I got them. They're dead. And they run this 15-minute film, and it's horrendous. And I looked for a hole. I thought, where am I going to escape out of this room? These people, they get paid a lot of money to work, and here they're here to meet us. They're taking this priceless time, about millions of dollars worth of time right there in that room. Well, they just sort of ignored that, and the governor got up, and I thought, oh, my God, now this will doom it. He'll get up and blab on and on politically. To my great surprise, the only politician I've ever known that could pull this off, he got up and talked for 15 minutes and didn't mention politics in any form, and he talked about New Mexico with his heart really truly in it, and he captivated that audience. And I came back here and brought a film to New Mexico 2 or 3 weeks later. It was the first film that the Film Commission had ever brought to New Mexico. And it was the first film commission in the United States of America. And it was The Good Guys and the Bad Guys, which they filmed up in the Chalma area. Now here came another terrible thing. Bert Kennedy, the director, I was responsible for him going up there. So he called me and he said, they're hijacking us up here and I'm really ticked off. I'm going to take this film out of here and move it to Colorado. He was really mad. He said, I'll put it in the trade papers. You'll never have a film in New Mexico again. And I said, hold on. I'll be up there and as fast as I can get there. So I went up there, and he showed me who and what. And I had a little talk with them, and one thing and another. They straightened up. The rest is history. You're seeing the films right today. But that's how hairy it was, how close it was to being the very beginning completely destroyed. Out of simple little local greed, I take a little credit for that.
Yeah.
It was very hard to do, and it really put me in jeopardy, and it hurt my feelings a lot. I'd been out all, I had spent all I had, you know, and probably borrowed from the bank to make that trip. I can't remember that. But it was delightful because we've had so many wonderful films made here since.
The film is called Old Max Evans, The First 1,000 Years, and it is screening on Sunday, February 4th at 1 o'clock at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. The film by Lorene Mills about Max Evans. Max and Lorene, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for all you do, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks, Lorene. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.